From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm David Watts Barton, editor-in-chief of the Sacramento Press, sitting in for Jeffrey Callison. Smart meters save money and time for utilities who no longer have to send technicians to your house to read the meter. It also allows utilities to adjust the amount of energy used by household appliances. But some have suggested that the very technology that makes them so useful also makes smart meters vulnerable to hackers. Joining me to discuss this is Ben Jun, Vice President of Cryptography at Cryptography Research, a private consulting firm. He's on the phone. Welcome.
Hi, David. It's good to be here.
Pleasure to have you. Let's first talk about smart meters and what they do, what the change has been.
Sure. So when we first use the word smart, I think it's important to characterize what that means. A smart meter is basically smart because it's connected. The brains of a smart meter are probably about the same as a mid-level cell phone today. And that connectivity is a game changer. There are two main roles to the meter itself. Its job is to measure a bunch of things, including your power usage. It also has a secondary role. It can do things like control the power to various circuits of your house. We can do things like turn off electric. We can shed air conditioners during peak use periods, that sort of thing. And the connectivity allows utilities to talk to these things on a minute-by-minute basis. And that's where some of the security concerns can come in.
So I understand you can actually go in to a circuit in a house and turn down the circuit that's running, say, an air conditioner if there's danger of, say, a brownout or of it overtaxing the circuit?
That's one of the promises of the system. It's not entirely, it's not necessarily running. The homeowner needs to approve what's going on. These meters have the ability to control different auxiliary circuits, and one auxiliary circuit might be your air conditioning compressor or other equipment at a commercial site. The other thing that we can do is these meters often have a local network that can do things like broadcast the amount of cost per usage per kilowatt hour to appliances in the house. Appliances can then decide when they want to turn on or when they want to turn off. You can think about your dishwasher waiting until the middle of the night where power is cheapest to run. So these are the capabilities of the system. The first deployments are not taking advantage of all of them.
Okay. So it does sound a little strange to have somebody from outside being, or maybe it's probably an algorithm, right? It's not a person, but controlling what your appliances are doing.
Well, it's part of what utilities are fielding to get better control and better monitoring of their networks. I think a more interesting question might be, what are people doing right now to circumvent meters, and how are the new meters going to change that? Existing meters right now do some very simple tasks. They serve as basically a utility meter serves a similar role as a fare meter in a taxi cab. Its job is to measure usage across different time zones or across different usage periods, and also provide that data to the utility. Today, we give that data in a very aggregated format. You basically send numbers that are your usage for the month. A power meter gives both the homeowner and the utility minute-by-minute data. And that's good because the homeowner can actually change their behavior. That can be troubling because minute-by-minute data can reveal things like if you're at home or not, if you're running a dishwasher or not, or other activity that's in your house.
So that was my next question, is what is the problem? Where's the entry point for somebody who wants to hack the system? What would be the benefit of somebody hacking into your own particular utilities?
Well, when you put a connected device out that can be essentially dialed into by an internet or IP address, a whole bunch of people might be interested in talking to it. The first attacks are probably not going to be privacy attacks. They're going to be people who are trying to find ways to spend less money on electricity. For example, if you're a pot grower right now, there's a lot of electricity use you have to mask. It actually takes a lot of energy to run a grow operation. There's a lot of documented cases where high electricity use was actually used as a suspicious flag by law enforcement. So people who are actually committing this crime at home are going to be more interested in masking their actual electric usage. There's also about $6 billion of fraud today on electricity. This is from Electric Light and Power magazine. $6 billion is the amount of money a utility loses when their metering systems are diverted or bypassed. Organized crime tends to get involved in this. They don't make the $6 billion, but they certainly get a cut of that by providing the tools that are required to do things like bypass your electric meter.
I hadn't heard that organized crime is involved in this. That's really interesting. So they're doing this in a mass way then. We're not talking just about maybe a pot grower or just a homeowner masking how much energy they're using. We're talking about sort of hijacking the system, it sounds like, for profit.
Well, when you see numbers as big as $6 billion of loss, there's a lot of sophistication behind a good portion of that attack. Generally, what happens is an organization will learn how to bypass a specific meter type that may be a very simple change. It may be somewhat complex. Then they find ways to monetize that, which basically involves going around to people and modifying the meters or doing whatever it takes for that meter to essentially run backwards or mask usage. Now, organized crime is going to take a very interesting view of these smart meters. You have a meter which is in constant communication with the utility, or near constant, which basically means that certain fraudulent activity is going to be harder to hide. You can't have a restaurant that's not using electricity during its peak dinner hour, for example. That would be too suspicious. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, these meters are not mechanical anymore. So they're easy to modify without a trace. In many cases, they're connected, so they can be hacked remotely. So if you're an attacker of these systems, you have to realize that, again, the game has changed. You can't use some of the same crude techniques you use to steal power. But if you have something that works, you can scale it very quickly and you can make a lot of money.
I'm speaking with Ben Jun. He's the vice president at Cryptography Research, a private security consulting firm. We offered SMUD and PG&E the opportunity to respond to this, but they declined. However, a spokesman for SMUD sent us this statement. Quote, "We are very confident in the security of our smart meters to protect our customers' privacy. We are bound by policy to not compromise the privacy rights of our customers. We are further bound by federal agency regulations to not disclose or discuss aspects of security related to the SMUD electrical grid." How have your concerns been addressed by utilities?
Well, there's a number of things that have been done. The CPUC in particular has had a number of hearings about privacy, and I think they're converging on a set of rules for how data should be tagged. Now, as an engineer, if we have a good set of policies for what is considered private data and what can be published, it's actually fairly straightforward to build a meter from the ground up that can respect those rules. For example, we can tag certain fields as fields that shouldn't be disclosed or disclosed only in certain situations. So I have some confidence that at the meter level, this will be addressed. What's more complicated is what happens when these meters have to interoperate with a whole collection of other meters from different companies or other equipment that may have come from a different manufacturer. How we can share data like electric usage data that has some privacy elements, that has to follow certain rules across these different companies and domains becomes more complicated.
Yeah, and you defined the word smart as being connected, which sort of leads into our other guest, who's Li Tian, who's a senior staff attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. He specializes in electronic free speech and privacy issues. Li Tian, welcome to Insight.
Glad to be here.
Your organization has been around practically since the founding of the web, I recall, and this is new territory. What troubles you about smart meters?
Well, we're really interested in smart meters as a problem on two fronts. One is the privacy front. As Ben mentioned, the kinds of data that you get from very, very high-resolution, granular electrical usage data tells you so much about what's going on inside the home. And we're particularly concerned about government or law enforcement access to that kind of data because it is like having a window into the home where the Fourth Amendment and other kinds of traditional constitutional rules have said, well, wait a minute, that's not someplace that the government should be able to intrude without a search warrant. So there's a real clash there on the privacy side. Then on the security side, you know, there's just a tremendous amount of evidence over the last 10 years that the smart grid, not just the meters themselves, but the smart grid itself has significant reliability and security problems. I mean, in the past, you know, they weren't so much cybersecurity problems, but even then, security tended to be minimal at substations and transmission lines. But the computerized dimension changes everything, because if you rely on a computer, then anything that affects a computer, like a virus or a bug in Windows, can affect the system. And if you rely on the Internet, then anything that affects the Internet, like a denial-of-service attack, can compromise things. And outside the United States, the CIA has already publicly discussed that there have been attacks on power grids in foreign countries with extortion. You know, this brings up, again, Ben's point about organized crime being the apparent goal.
And that connectivity, we're finding that smartphones can be an entryway into people's bank accounts, all sorts of things. Is there an actual problem with if somebody could get into, say, your SMUD account and see your SMUD usage or get into that part of the grid, they would be able to access other parts of your personal information?
Well, the there's really, if they were, I guess our focus has been on the, well, first of all, certainly anyone who has access to the data stream is, if they have the raw data, can potentially data mine and analyze that data in order to understand the patterns of activity in your household. The privacy concern scales, though, if you're able to see more and more households, as the utility might be able to, because then they can see not only sort of like microscopically and focus on one home, but they'll be able to see differences in demographics. They'll see how, what the sort of the average pattern is. And again, sort of relating to what Ben was saying about, say, marijuana grower operations, very much easier to sort of figure out baselines and then look for anomalies. But I think from the security standpoint, the big issue is that, you know, every smart meter, to the extent that it's connected into the distribution plane for these for the grid, then represents a sort of an edge device that can be an entry point for attack. Back in 2009, one of the security companies, IOActive, reported that they could that they were able to simulate a smart meter worm that infected about 15,000 home meters and then essentially gave control of the meters to them. So there are real questions about the security of the devices on the edge and then whether or not there are defenses or sort of safeguards between the edge and the rest of the system to prevent something that might turn into a serious attack.
Ben June, do you have suggestions for people? I mean, you can't decline a smart meter, right?
I think it depends on what jurisdiction you live in and the power company's rules. So I don't know about specifically there. Are you talking about advice for homeowners?
Yeah.
So there's a couple of things that I think that's trickier. I think part of being a modern society means realizing that there are certain risks of connectivity and data. I have smart meters in my house. I recognize that there is probably an increased chance of risk to certain kinds of attacks, and I'm willing to put up with that for the information that I get from the device itself. I think from a larger perspective, what does it mean to be fielding devices in people's houses that need to stay put for about 20 years or, in many cases, 50 years? I think Lee mentioned well, when you have things like fraud risk or infrastructure, the chance to do the opportunity for people to do infrastructure damage, most of those attacks and the skills required to come up with those are not going to be emerge immediately. And that's mostly because there's not a good critical mass of devices. You're not going to figure out how to attack something if you can only do a few homes. So we've got this sort of treadmill here where we're putting devices in place. They're not going to change for about 20 years. And we are not, the devices are not interesting enough to attackers. So we won't get a lot of feedback on how good a job we're doing until quite a bit down the road.
Okay, well, I think we're going to have to leave it there. It's a lot to think about. I'm speaking with Ben June, Vice President at Cryptography Research, and Lee Tien, Senior Staff Attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Thanks, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, the new Chancellor of UC Merced joins us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm David Watts Barton. Check us out on Facebook and become one of our fans. Our page is Insight on Capital Public Radio. California's San Joaquin Valley has been particularly hard hit in this economic downturn, but UC Merced's new chancellor thinks that her university can help lead the way out of tough times and into the next great wave of invention and economic growth. Chancellor Dorothy Leland is visiting the state capitol today to talk to legislators about what she thinks must be done to help the newest University of California campus do just that. And she joins us to discuss that and other matters. Chancellor Leland, welcome to Insight.
Good morning.
What is the current state of Merced and the San Joaquin economy in general?
Well, the San Joaquin Valley economy is in pretty bad situation, as you know, and large rates of unemployment, and it has a rural agricultural economy, and that economy means that the wages in the valley are quite depressed. So So there's a lot that a new research university can do to help diversify that economy and to really give it a new engine for the future.
And what are some of those?
Well, I mean, one of them is I think there are two things to really look at. One is educating more students. Since UC Merced has opened its doors to students, there's been over a 30% increase of students from the Valley admitted to UC institutions. That's a significant increase given levels of educational unattainment. And then the second area is research. Research, as you know, has been the economic engine of California, and it can stimulate a more diversified economy here in the Valley.
Now, you said a 30% increase in students from the Valley enrolling in UC. Is that at Merced, or is that throughout the system?
Not all of them, but many of them at UC Merced. About 30% of our students come from the San Joaquin Valley, about 30% from the San Francisco Bay Area, and about 30% from Los Angeles.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, it seems that it's part of the problem in the Valley particularly is the K-12 education getting people up to the point where they could actually get into a UC. Is that not right?
There are challenges there. We have a very, very strong outreach program for K-12 in the state. It's centered in Fresno. We not only work with the schools, but we work with the parents. Part of the challenge in the Valley is helping parents and families understand the importance of higher education and helping them to understand that it is attainable for their children.
And how big a campus is UC Merced relative to the other UCs? And it's also relatively new. What year did it actually open?
It opened its doors to students 6 years ago, so this is the sixth class of students. In fact, we have over 5,000 students now coming on campus, and we could accommodate many, many more if we could get more buildings up more quickly.
So that would make it the smallest by far, I would think, of the
UC
campus.
It is the smallest by far, and it's the youngest by far.
Mm-hmm. And does it have a focus in terms of, like, Davis at least started as an ag school?
We have research that is critical to the Valley. We have state-of-the-art research in water conservation, and we have a big research focus on sustainable energy, including efficient ways to harness solar energy. And we also have a significant research component looking at health disparities and health care issues in the Valley.
I'm speaking with Dorothy Leland. She's the new chancellor of UC Merced about her campus and its future. You're going to be visiting the Capitol today?
I am.
And what will you be saying to legislators? Are you going to be speaking to all of them, or are you going to be visiting certain legislators?
I'm visiting certain legislators, and as you know, when you're visiting legislators, the schedule is often in flux. So as I am traveling, it is in flux. But I hope to have a productive day. I come up about once a month. And I understand that there is a serious fiscal crisis in the state of California and that the state still faces a deep budget structural deficit. But I want people to remember that that research universities in California are what drove the economy to greatness once, and they will be central to doing that again. And when you think about UC Merced and the San Joaquin Valley, the San Joaquin Valley is the fastest-growing region of California, and the fate of the economy in the Valley will impact the entire state of California.
Mm-hmm. Do you worry that the Central Valley, particularly the southern Central Valley, San Joaquin Valley, and its more agricultural areas are being left behind by the coast? I mean, people have talked about these, we're sort of developing two states, the coastal economy and then the Central Valley.
I believe that that's one of the reasons that the University of California decided to put a UC campus in the Valley, so that the benefits that the coast has had from the University of California campuses that have been built there will also be benefits that our campus can bring to the Valley.
Now, you are I don't know where you're originally from, but your last job was in Florida, is that correct?
My last job was in Georgia, but I was born in California.
Oh, okay.
And I was born in Southern California in a little agricultural community called Pillmore.
And you've worked at UC Santa Cruz and a couple other campuses?
That's right. I've worked both in the Cal State system and at UC Santa Cruz.
And what do you find, what's interesting to you about Merced? What's unique about Merced that you found since going there?
Well, we have incredible students. We have the largest percentage of first-generation, low-income, and minority students of any UC campus. And these students are hungry for the educational opportunity they're getting. And so they're just fantastic students to work with.
Going back to your trip here today, legislators at the Capitol, what can legislators do? I'm assuming money is always sort of the main sticking point, but what will you be talking to them about specifically?
I will be talking to them about two things specifically. We need to look at strategies for unleashing capital dollars. It's so important for our campus. We could admit many more students if we could put up the facilities to accommodate the classrooms and the student support space. And as you know, there's been a significant decrease in the capital funding level in the state of California.
Mm-hmm.
And then secondly, we'll be looking to, we need to give both the University of California and the students and families we serve some predictability with respect to funding. It's been very unpredictable for the last few years, and that has meant that we have not been able to be as effective in planning and managing our resources, and our students have also been hit with unpredictable increases in the cost of going to college.
Mm-hmm. I'm speaking with Dorothy Leland. She's in town. She's the new chancellor of UC Merced and in town to visit the Capitol. Is it that you're just getting hit with budget cuts? You said the fluctuations. It seems that most fluctuations now are in a downward direction rather than up and down.
They are. They are. But we need to strike a new compact with the state and figure out how to keep our higher education institutions viable.
Do you find that higher education is a harder sell than it used to be? Are there some people who are saying, well, college graduates are doing much better in this recession than people without college degrees? Other people have been writing about, you know, a college education puts people into a lot of debt, and they come out, you know, already in debt at the beginning of their careers.
I think we need to look at public higher education as a public good, and we need to remember that the research out of UC institutions will drive the economy of California, and we really need to be concerned about what will be the future economic engine of this state.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of talk regarding that is around so-called green technology, and
yes.
you mentioned that that's something that you're one of the main focuses on your campus. Are there specific technologies or specific things that people are doing research on there that we may see showing up in the next few years in terms of green technology?
We're doing some really important work in solar, and I think you will be hearing more about that. And also, our campus is, in many ways, an experiment in green technology. We have every single one of our buildings is LEED certified, and all but one at the gold level. So it's a model for how to build a sustainable campus, and people come from all over the United States to look at how we've done it. So this looking at alternative energy and clean air and clean water, all of which is critical to the agricultural economy here in the San Joaquin Valley, will continue to be key focuses here.
And I should think that there would be quite a bit of interest by large companies or large funds in the kind of research that you're doing. Do you have particular large private funders that are unique to Merced?
We don't have any yet that are unique to UC Merced. We've really, this year we're making our initial hire of somebody that's going to look at bringing our inventions to market. So we now have a significant number of viable inventions out there, and so now we need somebody to work on bringing it to market, and they will find those partners for us.
Finally, how affected by its surroundings is UC Merced? Universities, particularly in smaller towns, tend to be kind of islands in the middle of, in this case, a lot of agricultural land. How do you connect out into that surrounding area?
We visit it often and frequently as possible. Our students, who are really committed to their communities, the students that are here from the Valley, there's a huge outreach program that our students are involved with, and they go back in their communities and they tutor in the schools and they work in social service agencies, and so it's fairly significant outreach.
All right. Well, good luck with your outreach at the Capitol today.
Thank you.
I'm speaking with Dorothy Leland. She is the new chancellor at UC Merced, and she's in town today. Thanks for joining us. You're listening to Insight on Capitol Public Radio. Coming up, local issues in the news with Sacramento News and Review's Nick Miller. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capitol Public Radio. I'm David Watts Barton. For more about the people and topics on our show, go to capradio.org/insight. Now it's time to find out what's happening in the news today with senior editor Alan Ray. He joins us from the newsroom. Alan, what's up?
Well, David, spraying is news today. Tonight, the Sacramento Yolo Vector Control District begins two nights of spraying against mosquitoes that could carry the West Nile virus. They found a lot of birds out there, dead birds, and mosquitoes carrying that virus. The spray area is in Elk Grove and Wilton in South Sacramento, and it's pretty extensive, 32,500 acres. That begins at 8 o'clock tonight. It'll run till midnight tonight and tomorrow night. There's also a demonstration of a mock fumigation today in Sacramento at the Capitol as environmental groups urge the state to reject the use of the pesticide methyl iodide. It's primarily used on strawberries. There are concerns its effects on farm workers and on the unborn could be severe. In January of this year, a coalition of farm workers, community advocates, and environmental health organizations sued to challenge California's approval, but they started using it on strawberries in February in Fresno down in May. And the question now is whether or not the legislature or the governor will reject its use altogether. There is a more serious question than where in the world is Carmen Sandiego right now in the Middle East. Rebels have taken Muammar Gaddafi's compound in Tripoli, but the dictator of 42 years is nowhere to be found or seen. The latest on the liberation of Libya, on All Things Considered, beginning at 3:30 this afternoon on Capitol Public Radio.
All right. Sounds like you have a new board game going there, Alan.
I think so, yes.
All right. Thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Well, usually at this point in Tuesday's shows, I'd be a guest speaking with Jeffrey about local news we're covering on the Sacramento Press. But since I'm in Jeffrey's seat today, we have Nick Miller, associate editor at Sacramento News and Review, to catch us up on what's happening in local news. Welcome, Nick.
Thanks, David. Thanks for having me.
So what have you got?
Well, where should we go first, man? Should we talk about fracking coming
to
Sacramento?
Yeah, in fact, that was something I was surprised to learn is even a local issue. That's fracking. That's an oil search for natural gas?
Correct, yeah. It involves taking millions and millions of gallons of water along with chemicals and sand, shooting it into the earth really deep, and then hopefully bringing up natural gas.
Mm-hmm.
A new report by a company based out of Colorado says that they're going to be exploring 20 spots within the Sacramento Basin. And so we're looking at, so what does that mean for Sacramento City, County? Does that mean people are going to be fracking in my backyard? Mm-hmm. Or what happened to all, in the case of all these well bores that already exist and been sealed off, will they be opening back up, looking for natural gas down in there? Two, at the state level, the Division of Oil, Gas, and Mineral Resources doesn't really have any regulations for fracking in the state of California. So whereas in Pennsylvania, where right. they had big problems, you've seen the movie Gasland,
yes.
right? We don't really have a lot on the books here that regulates that industry, so it's kind of a nebulous unknown It's going to be interesting.
I'm curious about the locations because, you know, when you drive further south in the valley, you get down by Bakersfield, you see more and more oil wells down there still sort of cranking away from years and years ago. But around this area, I don't remember ever seeing anything like that. Where are there natural gas deposits in this area?
The closest areas are going to be right now in the Sacramento Delta and then north of Sacramento in Sutter County. So you're talking 40 minutes out of the central city. Mm-hmm. And those are the ones with the closest proximity to downtown Sacramento, you know, Sacramento County. So
and that's pretty close.
I think so.
Yeah. closer in, we've all been focused on the redistricting drama, the Sacramento City Council, and there's going to be more of that tonight. But you, Sacramento News and Review, have been reporting on something else that the council did last week regarding the Climate Action Plan. What's that about?
Oh, after everyone from Oak Park converged on City Council and left. The council approved their climate action plan, which sets standards for 2020, 2030, and 2050 on greenhouse gas reductions, in addition to a multidimensional approach on how to hit those, changing the zoning code for building and zoning. And but the environmentalists were some of them who spoke with me were discouraged. They felt underrepresented for one, and two, they felt that there were too many concessions made to the Association of Realtors, too many concessions made to developers. And three, the Climate Action Plan has been postponed till 2014. And then even then, Councilwoman Sandy Sheedy said, if the economy's not better, we're going to have to rethink postponing it again. So there's serious concerns about whether we're even going to hit those 2020 goals right out the gate.
Because the thought is that that kind of regulation is hard on business or it costs more money and the economy can't afford it.
Exactly, exactly.
Hmm. I'm speaking with Nick Miller of the Sacramento News and Review about local news and events. Nick, a lot of people are getting unemployment right now, but as you're pointing out, they're not getting unemployment checks anymore.
That's correct. Bank of America is now distributing unemployment payments via a Visa debit card. So instead of being a California 99er, 99 weeks of unemployment, getting that check in the mail, you'll get a debit card that says Bank of America, says Visa on it. I assume it's red or blue. I don't know that yet. But the big concern from interested parties is that hidden fees, hidden charges. Mm-hmm. You get two deposits, withdrawals, every other week, and so you can take that money out and put it in your account. You don't have to have an account with Bank America. However, if you use that debit card to say buy gas, purchase groceries, there may be a hidden fee or a charge that the individual on employment may not be aware of. So, I mean, the EDD is saying they're going to save upward of $5 million a year by doing this. So, you know, under the crunch, it was a decision they made. But a lot of people are concerned that those on unemployment are going to be charged for things that they didn't know they were being charged for. So it's
and the savings is going to be because they're not giving people paper checks. They don't have to process it. They don't have to mail them out.
Precisely.
Although they still have to mail out the cards, right?
But one time, not well, how often do you get unemployment? Once a month? Twice a month?
I don't know. I'm happy to say. Let's go with twice a month. Well, no, I think it's probably once a month. But it sounds like what you're saying is that they have the card, and then they can access it anytime they want to.
Mm-hmm.
Two times a month.
They get two withdrawals every other week.
But they're limited on the amount of money that they can withdraw. It's up to a certain amount?
I don't know the answer to that.
Okay.
But I've been told that by our reporter, Hugh Bigger at SNR, that you'll withdraw and you can then put it in your normal account. You don't have to have an account with Bank of America.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like if you're smart about it, if you're educated, you'll be fine. You can avoid certain fees, but it is something different, you know, the state partnering with a bank like that. And I mean, Bank of America just laid off, 3,500 employees? Mm-hmm. So. Go ahead.
And people who've been getting unemployment checks and who get those kind of checks have often been taken advantage of by the check cashing places where they charge quite a fee. So
Definitely.
It'd be interesting to see how that plays out. And finally, you and I are both big local music fans. you're particularly up on it. You got the 20th anniversary of the SAMMYs, the Sacramento Area Music Awards.
That's right. 2 decades. It's exciting this year. I kind of look to our sister paper in Austin, the Austin Chronicle, because they've been doing the music awards for much longer. They do it really well. This year, we have 40 different categories. Some of the most exciting stuff going on, and it kind of blows my mind, is the music videos that are coming out of this town and that rival anything you're going to see on MTV or online because of the affordability of camera photography and equipment and the talent of the music video directors and the editors involved. Just amazing stuff.
Anyone in particular that you've the videos that you've seen that you were really wowed by?
Yeah, three guys. A hip hop director named Eric Lee, who works with a rapper named C Plus, as part of a company called Boss Media. Excellent music videos, and they make. I mean, he's made three for this album, three videos for one local album. Additionally, Sean Stout from TerrorEyes.tv, fantastic local video producer. He did a video for Zach Hill called The Sacto Smile that's just so entertaining, so well made. And also a guy named Flatlander. That's his moniker he produces under, who's a member of the band Death Grips, who is just blowing up right now, something that would, you know, rival Cake or Deftones. They're playing England and London next week. They just played the Mad Decent Block Party Festival in Los Angeles with Diplo, and the electronic music scene right now and the hip hop music scene in Sacramento is very strong, very strong.
And where does one go to see electronic music in Sacramento?
Well, that's the thing. a lot of these guys are playing at the Townhouse Lounge. They're playing underground shows, and quite honestly, and you've heard this probably a million times in your life, we're really popular not in Sacramento.
Right. Yeah, it happens all the time. People get to be quite big names outside of Sacramento and never quite blow up here. Mm-hmm. Who are your, besides the videos, who are some of the people? I know you don't want to play favorites because you're an impartial judge, but who are some of your favorites in town right now?
Oh, I mean, I like Death Grips. I like Sister Crown. I like Sea of Bees. I like Ganglions. I even like some of the funk bands who will play at like Torch Club, like the Nibblers, Nickel Slots, Golden Cadillacs. A Lot Like Birds is a screamo hardcore band from Citrus Heights that just went up to Portland to record with a pretty major producer and will probably do really well on the national tour scene. It's great to see these guys doing well, and my job's amazing because I just get to share them with people. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know? It's fun.
And you, give us the time frame for the Sammys in terms of this is nominations that just opened, right?
Sure. Yes, we're announcing the nominees this Thursday in the issue of SNR, and the winners will be announced on October 1st on a block party on 20th Street from 5 to 10 p.m. It's free. It's going to be a great time. We just want people to come out and check out these local talents. You know, it's fun.
All right. Well, Nick Miller from Sacramento News and Review, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, David.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, photographer Julian Cash and Burning Man. We'll be right back. Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm David Watts Barton. Insight streams live online. Check it out at capradio.org/insight. Bay Area photographer Julian Cash set up a unique photo booth at Burning Man a few years back, and with funds gathered from friends and on the website Kickstarter, he managed to get enough together to publish the book The People of Burning Man, which just came out. Burning Man starts on Monday or Sunday night at midnight, and Julian Cash joins us by phone from San Francisco, where he is busily packing for his trip. Welcome to Insight.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Your book is called The People of Burning Man. You know, there have been a lot of books about Burning Man, a lot of movies. What makes this one unique?
Most of the books about Burning Man right now are books where you get to see pictures of people running around in the dust. And I set up a studio so that it specifically could be people photographed where they're isolated from the environment. For me, part of the whole point is not just that it show what Burning Man is to burners, but rather show just the people and the personalities and how amazing the people and freak, how amazing self-expression can be to people that don't necessarily think of themselves as people that care about Burning Man.
Mm-hmm.
And so in other words, there's if there's someone in South Dakota who doesn't know about Burning Man, I want them to see how much people can express themselves, how they can hopefully change.
And you did this over a period of time. I said a couple of years back, but it sounds like you actually have done this over a number of years.
Yeah, close to a decade of shooting, and then many years after that of editing and getting everything just right. And then once the Kickstarter worked out, once the community made it so that this book could exist, we put a bunch more energy into it, making it so that it could be as perfect as possible.
Now, for anyone who's been to Burning Man, there are a lot of very photogenic people out there for a lot of different reasons. What criteria did you use to choose the photos that ended up in the book, or even what criteria did you use to shoot the people in the first place?
It's interesting. I never like to say no to anybody. And so at first we set up and then people would come and I'd photograph everybody. And then after a while, it ended up being that meant we were photographing, there were lines, and I hate lines, people having to wait. So we ended up having people in the camp go out, find folks that were fun, and see if they wanted to be photographed, and then doing photos that way. So for many years, that was the main point. And then later on, I got more into doing things that were collaborations that were more political, more spiritual sometimes, where I would ask people how they want the world to be different. And then we would talk and come up with an image that would help make the world different in the way that they wanted it changed. And then together, we would make that image at Burning Man, and a lot of my favorite images in the book came from that type of collaboration.
And we have some of those photos on our website at caprio.org/insight, and we also have a link to your website so people can go look at those pictures. At the beginning of the book, you say this is a recipe book, not a museum. What does that mean?
Museums, you go and you stare at stuff, and then you leave, and they're sort of intended as you just look at these things. And for my hope is that people will look at the book and see how they can, what they want to take of that from themselves, what recipe they want from this, where maybe they say, you know, I've been ashamed of my body my whole life, and that's not really useful. Or maybe they seem embarrassed to dress up too elaborate and ridiculous, and maybe they'll, this, you know, on this particular day, wear a hat that's a lot more crazy than they might do otherwise. I just think self-expression is something that really makes people grow and more vibrant and more alive, and hiding is not.
You ask the question in the book at the very beginning, you say, is self-expression vital or merely nifty? I imagine you fall on the first side of that.
I'm biased. There's a few things in life that make life worth living. I mean, there's the normal, you need shelter and food and ideally sex, but people you want more than that, more than just that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the main thing that fills in for the rest of us is, you know, family is part of it. TV is a big part for the world, which actually is creativity. But being able to express yourself and dive into art in a huge way gives life meaning in a way that's far more than just the basic necessities.
And that's something that it sounds like was a part of your own personal process in going to Burning Man and discovering that for yourself.
Yes, when my wife and I first went the first year, I was like, okay, we're supposed to do, like, gifting stuff, so I went to Costco and got cookies and passed out cookies, which was nice. That was good.
Mm-hmm.
And I had, before that, I had some costumes and outfit stuff that was sort of crazy and fun, and the parties I was going to were not the right parties, and they just, people didn't like, it just didn't mesh up properly, and I was, like, yard-sailed them, and then at Burning Man, I was wearing a Marge Simpson hat, which I just mean, it definitely helped me to be who I am, to feel comfortable in expressing myself in the way that I love to, and being a nut in the right ways.
I'm speaking with photographer Julian Cash, whose new book is called The People of Burning Man. And speaking of self-expression, this is a book of photography, and it's beautiful photography, quite apart from the subjects. You set up in a small tent, it looks like, out on the playa, the open flatlands that Burning Man takes place on. What kind of cameras are, not to get too technical, but it seems like you're using like sort of fisheye lenses, and there's a lot of depth in the photography considering that it took place in a very small space.
It's amazing how many people you can fit in a 10-foot by 10-foot studio. And then there were also some shots that would not fit in the studio. So there was one year that there was a Black Rock refinery, and they had this giant 25-foot white wall. And so some of the pictures that wouldn't fit in the studio, we'd run out and set up a makeshift studio using their 25-foot white wall. It's sort of, people out there are so alive compared to the default world. And for me, I would get to endlessly just have profound moments with amazing people. And so it comes out in the photos somewhat, which is really, really nice. And then you mentioned the editing before, and I didn't actually cover that. I think there's about 75,000 pictures we took. There's around 1,000 in the book, in various sizes and various ways. Mm-hmm. My wife, Jackie Jack, is an amazing editor, and she did most of the picking, because it's really hard to pick the good, you know, the ones that deserve it the most when there's so many that deserve it.
Well, and you also have some of the pictures are very up close pictures of one individual. A lot of the pictures are of large groups of people. As you said, you can get a lot of people into a 10 by 10 space. How did you choose between those? Because there's a lot of design in the book. The book is not just a one page, one photo. You really play with the structure of the book and the photos. How much of that was you? Was that Jackie as well, or did you have another editor involved?
There's a lot of people that helped in different ways. They're listed in the book, but Robert, Esso, Kelsey, Randall, there's a lot of people that helped. The book of all, it's kind of, well, part of what was nice was that we printed up a version, and then a few years later we printed up another version, and then a few years later we printed up another version, and we kept user testing them. So we got a lot of people giving good advice on what to do. Mostly it was Jackie, but Jackie and I figuring things out. You mentioned fisheye. I love shooting fisheye. It's just fun. It just makes things more over the top, and you can zoom in on the one thing you care about most with people.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for joining us. Julian Cash's new book is The People of Burning Man, and we'll let you get back to packing, huh?
Oh, wait. Oh. So if you go to thepeopleofburningman.com, you can order a copy.
Okay. That's important information, yeah. All right. Well, thanks for joining us, Julian.
Thank you so much. Thanks.
Take care and have a good burn.
You too.
And that's Insight for today. I'm David Watts Barton of the Sacramento Press. Insight's assistant producer is James Morrison. Today's associate producer was Liz Cazares. Our technical director is Mark Jones. And Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. Thank you for joining us. Sacramento County's longtime public health officer is retiring. On the next Insight, we'll talk with Glenna Troche about the many changes she experienced during her tenure. Also, a public hearing is held on housing conditions at Pelican Bay after a 20-day hunger strike by prisoners. We'll talk about it. And a local author releases a new book about four sisters who learn about family from their father's deathbed. I'm David Watts Barton. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.